Everyone, it's now just after 10:30, so we'll get started. My name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Joe.
Welcome to this closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Brighton Al-Anon Convention 2024. If you think you have a problem with alcohol, you are welcome to attend this meeting. Can I ask that you please ensure your phone is turned off or on silent? Let's now take a quiet moment to gather our thoughts. Close the windows. I've asked Henry to read the preamble.
Hi, Henry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Henry.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, and they may solve the common problems and help others overcome from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees in AA membership. We are self-supported through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you. This is an hour-long meeting, closing at 11:30, with three speakers each sharing for 10 to 15 minutes on a relevant topic of their choice. There will then be time for sharing back from the floor. Our first speaker is Cara, so over to you.
Hi, I'm Cara, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Cara.
It's really good to be here. So I am going to speak on the topic of avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. And just before that kind of line in the book, there's a paragraph, and included in it is like, we have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things, and speaking about people sinking into the mire of alcoholism. And it was when I came back to AA for the last time that it really sunk in that I was locked in this progressive and fatal downward spiral. It didn't matter how bad things were getting, like my mind would go drink and I would drink. And I had so much evidence that me drinking was a really bad idea, but I couldn't stop. By that time, I was ending up in hospital. I would deliberately or accidentally harm myself, and my conduct and behaviour to my family and loved ones was vicious. But my mind would go drink, and I would just be off again. And once I started, I would drink way more than I intended. Like, I would completely lose control. And it ended with me at the end of my drinking, shaking in bed, couldn't even keep water down, but I was still trying to get more alcohol in me. And I was so baffled until I got to AA and found out that I've got like this double-edged sword of a mental obsession of mine that will always take me back there. And this phenomenon of craving, I kick something off when I start drinking and I can't stop. And it was when I came back to AA the last, because I've been in and out of a few years, and I kind of had the illusion that I'd be able to keep on doing that. And it was when I started working with a sponsor this time that it really sunk in that if I drink again, I might never make it back here. I do really dangerous things when I'm drinking. And also, I'm kicking off something that doesn't want to come back. I'm done when it's done, and that might be never done. And like, it sunk in that the horrific alcoholic death might be years and years of daily drinking. And it was when I came back here last time that someone said to me, it does not have to be the story that you drink again. Like, this program works. Get into the middle of AA and stay there. And they said that power other people have accessed in the rooms, it's available to you too. You've just got to do what they did, which was the steps. And so I started taking action. And this program, it saved my life. And so, yeah, I'm glad I started working the steps. And I thought, there's also a line in that kind of section of the book where it says, we made our own misery. And I didn't think that was the case when I got here, but I learned when I was on step four that it was my thinking, my beliefs, and my behaviours that were causing my misery. And those things changed by working the steps. And it was because I thought I'd get sober, but then I'd continue to just be so gloomy and miserable, and that wasn't what was on offer here. It's like when I was a teenager, I kind of looked at the world and would make really big claims, like, life has no meaning, I don't want to stick around for this. And I thought it was edgy, and I thought it was cool at stages. And I'd kind of got stuck with this really gloomy perception. I remember when I was on step four, having some conversations with my sponsor where these belief structures were getting absolutely blown apart, and I realised it wasn't the world that was causing my misery, it was my, like, beliefs, and they were wrong, and there was another way to see things. And I'd also had this kind of idea that I was going to be broken forever, and that wasn't the case. It was like having some of my behaviours reduced down to the defects. And it was like these moments when I realised, like, oh, I can, with God's help, start acting and thinking in line with spiritual program, like, principles, and that there was a way out of the absolute hell of the way I'd been living. And I was also learning, so I'd have these conversations with my sponsor or, like, other fellows, and sometimes they'd just ask me, like, a couple of questions or say one sentence, and I'd literally shake as the belief structure crumbled and I realised I was a bit more free. And that was happening more and more as I was going through the steps. And I also kind of learned that it was kind of my thinking that was a problem, and my thinking was very, very destructive, and I was starting to learn things like repeating prayers, going and doing, like someone said, if you wake up in the morning, like, ask God to direct your thinking, and then go and do like five really useful, practical, concrete things. And I was doing that, and it would get me back in reality and out of my head. So things were really starting to change. I was going through the steps. And the other thing was, like, I recoiled in horror from self when I was on my step four. And that's the thing, it says, like, a life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I thought I just need to try harder, and really I needed to give up the whole show, like, and instead of serving self, serve God instead. Like, when I was just trying to find the solution in the material world, it ended up with, like, the ego was absolutely insatiable. I was trying to drag myself to the top. It was never enough. Like, even when I was getting the things I wanted, I was not happy. I was full of fear of losing it, and it was on to the next thing. And it ended up with me just wanting to, get to the point where I was like, I just don't want to exist. I got an email and something had gone well, and I just was so exhausted and was like, I cannot do this anymore. And so I needed another way, and it was serving God, not self. The selfishness and self-centeredness, it was going to kill me. And so it was also, so I really made that step three decision, which was like turning my will and my life over to the care of God and saying, I don't have a life anymore, it's God. And someone said to me, your job now is to be a good custodian. And so I had to look at, what else am I doing that is making me miserable? And when I was on step four, I applied kind of this page 67 questions to all areas, like, what are my mistakes? Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened? Where was I to blame, and what were my wrongs? And there was a lot of stuff I was doing that needed to change. And a lot of feedback I was getting at that time was some of the most helpful feedback, which was to grow up and take responsibility. And I found that God will give me the strength to take the next right action. And so that stuff started to change as well. And so my focus started to change to being of, like, maximum service to God. And there's also a part in that reading where it says we absolutely insist on doing life, and cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And I wasn't very cheerful at the beginning, and it was remarkable what happened when I said to God, God, show me how to see this, and said, I'm going to go out into the day and focus on being cheerful, useful and kind. And there were these moments as I was going through the steps, like, where I was getting little glimpses of it. So I'd go to a meeting feeling terrible, and then I'd do my service commitment. I would just focus on making the tea, and I wasn't wrapped up in me and like my pain. And then someone would say something in the meeting and I'd laugh, and just for a second I'd forget myself. And that was happening more and more as I was going through the steps. And I just remember this moment when I just really threw myself into helping others and like sponsoring and working with other alcoholics. And at the beginning it felt like I was kind of dragging myself through concrete, but I just remember there was this one meeting where I was sat talking to someone who was one day sober, and just this little thought came like, this is what I'm here for. And so the steps, it gave me a primary purpose of staying sober and helping other alcoholics. And so I did get a sufficient substitute here. There's a line in another part of the book that, yeah, the substitute is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's vastly more than that. And it said, life will mean something at last, and that the most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. And I'm so glad I got to stick around to kind of see that and start to see that. And, one sec. And there's a part in Bill's story as well where it says there's a vast amount of fun about it all, and there was for me. It went from me like just drinking on my own in my room to doing service, to getting commitments, to doing fellowship and stuff like that, and it was brilliant. But then there's also this, like, this deadly earnestness underlying it all, like, because this is life and death for me. Like, I cannot go back to drinking because I might never stop. And there's also a line in the family afterwards, like, if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalise it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And I saw something that really, really, like, blew me away, was I saw people going through things that would have been, like, my feared things, and they were still showing up at meetings, being cheerful and being useful. And it taught me that it's possible to stay sober whatever happens. Like, and so then when I got news where I was like, ooh, that hurts a little bit, I knew it was possible to kind of ask God for the next right action and then do it. And that nothing outside of me can really harm me. It is my reaction, and I can choose to rely on infinite God. And so from the beginning, my sponsor suggested I say in the morning, like, God, what do you want me to do today? And write a day plan. And then, so I'm praying and asking for direction, what to do today, and then strength, the ability to do it. And that's what I've been doing recently. And yeah, I can choose to rely on God. And the results is, like, I'm sober, and it's hard to put into words what it's, how much this program's done for me. The fact that, like, this power has pulled me back from the gates of insanity and, like, this horrific alcoholic death. And so I hope that while I'm in the world, I get to stay here just trying to carry the message, because really it was God and the unity of this fellowship that I was looking for all along. And I think I will leave it there.
Thanks, Cara.
Over to Tom.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning, everyone. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to start with a reading from The Family Afterwards, page 123. Now and then, the family will be plagued by spectres from the past, for the drinking career of almost every alcoholic. Let's put my timer on. For the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful or tragic. The first impulse will be to bury these skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. The family may be possessed by the idea that future happiness can be based upon only upon forgetfulness of the past. We think that such a view is self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with the problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should only be too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter grievous, how grievous, out of their hiding place. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem worthwhile to us now. Cling to that thought that in God's hand, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Really great to be here. Thank you for asking. And I wanted to talk about my experience and my family's experience from before and then after being in AA. So if I was, if we talk about sort of skeletons from the past and all the things that would happen as a result of my drinking, this Seven Dials area of Brighton, I actually, I lived here for 12 years. And so funny, humiliating, shameful, tragic, a lot of things went on around here that I was very shameful of. And because when I pick up a drink, something happens and it changes sort of the direction that I'm going in, and the Jekyll and Hyde description is very very sort of suitable for me. But from when I started drinking, it was something that allowed me to be the person who I thought I was, and it removed a lot of the self-consciousness and a lot of the fear and the doubts that was in me. And so in the 20 years of my drinking, I'd sort of picked up a lot of stuff that I was shameful of. And it was weighing me down. But for the outside world, I was very, very focused and wanted everyone to see how well that I was doing, and very focused on my job and what other people thought of me was the thing that really drove my decisions. And so from coming into the rooms and on the January of 2022, it had been a long and slow decision to do that. But I couldn't quite put my finger on why I was finding myself in situations that I didn't want to be in, still doing things that I told myself I'd never do again, and repeating the actions. And so coming in broken, but maybe for the outside world, it seemed that I sort of had it all. And so it was from actually asking someone to help, finally, because I didn't think that, you know, coming into the rooms, it was just going to be that I've got a problem with my drinking. The thing that really has helped is I hadn't realized until we got to the step four process of all of the resentments that were sort of within me. And so for my family, when I sort of was asked to sort of put down my resentments on paper, my sponsor said at the time, let's just start with an easy one. And I sort of came back and was like, brilliant, let's go with my dad. And they're like, no, don't mean it like that. As in, like, I was so top of the list was mum and dad, because I was, my sister had committed suicide. I blamed them for the life that we'd had. Mum was an alcoholic. And so it was all about how bad things were for me. And the narrative that I was the victim. And although when I lined up some of the accusations, really drilling down, there was actually nothing. There was nothing there. It's so futile. And with my mum, of not being around when I was younger, I was told I had to forgive, and I had to forgive her, and asked to sort of to pray for her as a sick person. Was something that was alien to me, and to see from her own perspective. And actually, when we sort of looked at the resentments, one of them was when I was about 20, I saw an A4 pad that had lots of writing on it. And the thing that sort of stuck out to me was, I'm worried that Tom's relationship with women is not a positive one. And I was like, how dare she? How dare she sort of write this? And so now I can see that I was actually reading her her step four that she was sort of would have been going through at the time. And so, but if I then drill down into my, from going through the steps and my sex inventory and actually from my behaviours, as in like me having a resentment over that is actually ridiculous. And so with the process of forgiving her and being able to try to have a relationship with family members that actually doesn't put me at the front of being the victim, I found that I was very reluctant to tell my mum that I was in the rooms, and I was sort of really waited and said, well, I want to make sure that it's in God's time, because the first thing I wanted to do straight away was like, well, I'm now in AA and I'm going to sort of tell you sort of how it all is. And it was a really special moment of when that sort of came out. And it was on the anniversary of my sister's death, and I'd been asked to do some service, and so I was sharing it at a meeting late at night, and I hadn't spoken to her yet in that day, and I was cycling back home, and she just said, I asked how have you been, considering the day, and she said she'd been upset, but she was also upset about me, because I had a friend who is ill, and he's has a terminal illness, and I just said to her, I'm gonna be okay. I said I've been in AA for a year and a half, and I'm gonna be okay. And her reaction, she was just so taken aback, and she said, I'm so pleased that I thought I was, I was worried I was going to lose you as well. And that conversation of actually sort of hearing from her about her worry and concern about how I was living my life, we're now able to try to develop a relationship that has to be on boundaries, and I need my program, and I need to ensure that I'm staying, keeping close to fellows and my sponsor, because all I'd need to look at it now is how can I be of service to the family and in the home, and take it away from the focus on me, and that's all been, that's helped me, the program has helped me to see that, and so if I bring it to the present day, how do I try to sort of work the program? I go to regular meetings, I try to be of service, I have a sponsor, I pray every day, and it allows me to try to sort of to stay connected, because if I leave to my own thoughts and devices, it can very quickly be clear that I will blame, I will be resentful, and I don't want to live that life anymore. So thank you again for listening, and I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Tom.
Tom?
Oh, thank you. Tom, our colleague.
Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone. I don't quite know how to follow both of those people. I think you guys are slightly more meticulously planned than I was. But I think one thing I love about AA is I realise I've landed in a group of people that seem to be broken in the same way that I am. People that get on with this tend to seem to be healing and having much of a good time. People that talk about God a lot seem to be having a good time. But I absolutely love the gallows humour of AA. Like when I turn to my colleague and I say, I remember this one time 7 years ago, a combination of drink and drugs led me to lose 2 whole weeks of my life. They're absolutely horrified. And in AA, they're like, haha, come on, buddy, sit down. Like, and I'm just like, ah, yes, I've landed in the right place. These people seem to know the darkness, but they also seem to be moving towards like healing and being happy. And I'm just like, man, what a fucking relief that I finally like found out what's wrong with me. So there's a guy down here that, he always says, if your life's unmanageable, maybe you need a new manager. And so like the steps really are just a standardized connect, you know, like a standardized process of activating this connection with a higher power, and the byproduct seems to be sobriety. And because we're at an Al-Anon convention, I thought really what I should talk about, having looked at the family afterwards and to wives, I was just like, so much of what we do in the steps has to do with relationships, how we relate to other people and like how we conduct ourselves. So I just thought today I'd talk a little bit about like a couple of the funny ideas I think I had around family, relationships, how I should behave and stuff. So I think the first thing is, I wanted to talk about blame. I spent lots of years being very angry that I was an alcoholic and an addict. And I wanted to blame my parents for that. And I spent a very long time being very cruel to my mum, telling her that it was her fault that I got alcoholism, or my dad. The thing is, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad could be very, very cruel. And it's maybe an argument that my childhood expedited the process of my alcoholism, but I'm really not sure that it ever caused it. I think my childhood just gave me an interesting step five. I'm not sure that it actually made my alcoholism. And the thing is, there's a part of me that really enjoys blaming, because it absolves me. I feel like it absolves me of all responsibility of my actions for actually getting on with anything. But when I look at how my conduct affects other people when I'm blaming, it makes me angry and it makes me really boring and difficult to be around. Because when I'm in blame mode, like the most interesting topic of conversation is, let me tell you every single bad thing that's ever happened to me, and then wonder why people leave and I felt lonely. Like there was very little back and forth. There was very little genuine actually wanting to get to know someone. It was just like waiting for my turn in the conversation to spill out all the darkness. And then anyone that was healthy would be like, I think I'm okay, Tom. And then they would just kind of leave. And so I think the real thing that turned the corner with this blame stuff is like, I literally don't know what caused my alcoholism. And also it doesn't matter. Like the why I became alcoholic is just not important. The question is, how do I know that I have it? Do I have this combination of the physical craving and the mental obsession? And what do I need to do about it, right? The steps, the content really of the steps is kind of 7 things. It's forgiving everyone for everything, not having any secrets, making amends for everything, paying back all the creditors I have, praying and meditating, being mindful of my conduct as I go through that, thought life and conduct as I go throughout the day, and trying to be useful inside and outside of AA. So doing my job, being nice to my mum. I'm trying to sponsor other people. Really, everyone that's doing those things seems to be like largely on a healing path. Like everyone goes up and down a bit, but those people always seem to be fine. And the second thing is, I want to talk about like criticism and offering unsolicited advice. So I spent a very long time, specifically with my mum and my brother, being absolutely convinced that I knew what they needed to do in order to be happy. And I wasted absolutely no time telling them in no uncertain terms everything they needed to do and the timescales which they needed to do it. Like I remember in my first 2 months of sobriety, I was insane. I was coming to meetings and I was screaming and crying at every single meeting. And then I'd be on the phone to my mum like, Mum, I think you need to go to Al-Anon. And then she went to an Al-Anon meeting and she was like, they just sit around and complain. Why don't they get on doing stuff? And I was like, oh yeah, fair enough. You know, and what's interesting about the offering criticism and unsolicited advice, especially to my family, it was like, I told myself it was like, oh, you know, so like they'd be happier, and maybe that's not true, but the only stuff that really concerned me, the only stuff that I like gave them advice on was where it concerned me, where I then, where it would make my life easier. So it always comes back to any advice I'm given, especially of my mum and my brother, it's just because I think I'd end up being happier. I didn't actually, it was all selfish. Like, I could justify it saying that they would be happier, but if I'm being really honest, I didn't give much of a shit. I really just wanted my life to be easier, and if they got happier, then it would be nice. And the experience, so I've, being now in AA for sort of over three and a half years, I've had the experience of people giving me feedback when I've not asked for it. See, the experience of being given feedback when you haven't asked for it, when I give feedback, what it feels like I'm doing is like, you know, like letting someone know in a very loving way, like a, this very important piece of information they're definitely not aware of, and that's then going to lead them to have some kind of life-changing epiphany. But being on the receiving end of feedback that I haven't asked for, it's just really annoying. I don't want to do it. Largely, I just think, well, I'm just going to ignore you even harder now. I might have done that, but if you tell me, then I'm just not going to do it. And with my, especially with my mum and my brother, I could be very cruel with it. And there's a line by Don Pritz, and he just says, like, truth without love is just brutality. And I think that's largely what I was like when I was talking to my mum and my brother. And I spent a large amount of my life really disliking myself, like calling myself. There's another member down here that talks about shit FM that plays in your head, the constant bangers, everyone hates you, you should kill yourself, blah, 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 blah. And before coming to the program, you know, the narrative would play, everyone hates you. And then there would be a long list of 60 or 70 people that I'd behave badly with, and it could pick any one of those and be like, look at that. Look how badly you treated all your ex-girlfriends. Look at all those kids you harmed in school. And I'd be like, yeah, man, I am a terrible person. And the thing is, going through steps 8 and 9 and making amends to everyone for everything I've ever done, it is much more difficult to carry on like feeling like a piece of shit when there's nothing from my past that I can hang it on anymore. Like, the narrative will still occasionally be there, like, Tom, you're rubbish, no one likes you, but there's nothing from my past anymore to like hang it on, you know? And I guess the other thing I would say from the amends process, I kind of thought maybe we lived in a slightly idealized world. I thought that, you know, you make amends and that's it, you're best friends with everyone. Everyone loves you, there's never any problems anymore. But my behavior, my like cruel and critical behavior, especially towards my mum and my brother, you know, it warped that relationship. It warped that relationship, and it took quite a long time, I think, for my mum and my brother to actually feel like calm and like safe around me. And it was probably like a good couple of years between that like one amends conversation and really feeling like I'd got the relationship back with my mum and my brother. Like, it takes quite a long time for people to like see that you can consistently turn up and actually start to behave well. And if you've heard this story before, I apologize, but I remember about a year ago, I had an experience where I really felt like I was forgiven by my mum for the first time. I was sat in a tea room with my mum and her boyfriend Pete, and Pete said, he laughed and he went, haha, you're awful. And I said, you should have seen me when I was drinking, Pete. And then I turned to my mum, and my mum said, and she laughed, and she went, haha, you were fucking awful. And what was amazing about that moment was I'd made amends to my mum about 2 years prior to that. And in between those 2 years, as much as I'd like acknowledged all the harm, and I'd put everything right to the extent that I could, it was still like a gray cloud over the relationship that we never spoke about. Like, it was this kind of gray, dark thing that we just never mentioned. And in that moment, I wanted to burst into tears, because what it felt like, it was the first time when my mum saw that stuff wasn't going on anymore, and it felt like she trusted me again. And every time I talk about it, I want to cry, because like, if that's the kind of healing that goes on here, like, I'm signed up for life. Like, that's amazing. I can bitch and moan about service being annoying and sponsorship being like kind of inconvenient, but like, if that's the price to pay for stuff of like, healing relationships like that, like, yeah, I'm here for the long run. So yeah, I'll leave it there. I've run out of stuff to say, but thanks.
Thanks, Tom.